This episode is made possible by StackAdapt. Need digital creatives fast? Don't have the time or resources to hire a design team? With StackAdapt, you can build captivating creatives to take your brand from your idea bank to your audience. The creative builder in StackAdapt will save you time, cut costs, and simplify your creative workflow. Head to go.stackadapt.com/creativebuilder and request your demo today. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen and e-marketer podcast made possible by StackAdapt. This is the Friday show that takes his TV upstairs to bed with it at nighttime. No one else? Nothing? Okay. It sounds like I don't trust
have an upstairs
the other people
to go
living
to.
With me.
I don't have an upstairs to... I have a one-floor living space.
Did you just take it? Sometimes if you're watching TV with Mrs. Ross, will you just take it out of the room when you're done? Just
take I take mine into the bathroom.
There's only two rooms to go into, and they both have TVs, so...
Oh, okay.
I guess I could put two in one. Yeah. We want to sit together and watch different stuff.
What the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Just me. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Prime launches its ads tier. Just how honest will advertising get? Are face computers inevitable? Will Netflix be able to build a significant gaming hub? And I have some more facts about retirement. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with one of our senior analysts. They're all senior analysts, but one of them is on our digital advertising and media desk based in Philadelphia. It's Max Willens.
Yo.
Hey, fella. We're also joined by someone else on his very desk, but this time he is based just north of New York City. It's Ross Benish.
Hey, Marcus.
Hey, fella. And finally, we have one of those senior analysts, but on the retail and e-commerce team. He is based in New York City proper, and we refer to him as Blake Drush.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, buddy. So what do we have in store for you today? We start with the story of the week. We're talking about Prime with ads and how that's going to change the game. We move to the debate of the week is what we have for you this week, where our panel will try to give you the best for and against arguments they can from each of the three stories we have for you. We end with some random trivia, but of course we start with the story of the week. So, Prime with ads appeal. Amazon's ad-supported tier for Prime Video launched this week, and it is offering lower ad prices than competitors, projecting massive reach thanks to a plan that automatically enrolls consumers, writes Catherine Perloff and Bill Bradley of Adweek. They note that Prime Video is coming to the market with CPMs in the mid to low $30 range, in line with prices for its Thursday Night Football inventory. For context, Netflix launched with prices that were twice as high. HBO Max's ads also cost more, as well as some other folks. Ross, I'll start with you. You have more heavy focus on video than anyone else. Your thoughts now that Prime with ads is here?
Well, it makes sense that they'd have a lower price than Netflix, because even though it's the first time Prime Video is having ads for a lot of this content, Amazon isn't building an ad business from scratch. So they're just extending what they're already doing. And we expect it to add a few billion dollars a year to the U.S. market beyond what they're already doing with Freevee, Fire TV, and Twitch. So it's pretty significant, to the point that we had to raise our overall U.S. CTV forecast for it.
Mm-hmm. This is the over $3 billion this year.
Well, that's some firms are estimating that. We're not estimating quite that high for just Prime Video. But I mean, if you take all of Amazon,
right,
then yes.
Right.
Yeah, because our estimate is all of Amazon. So that includes Freevee and Fire inventory as well. And if you add all that, then yep, over $3 billion.
That's right. That's right. So the arrival of Prime Video with ads will help bump its existing portfolio and more than double Amazon CTV ad revenues from nearly $1.5 billion last year to over $3 billion this year. But to Ross's point, that's all of Amazon CTV ad revenues in the US. Max, what do you make of this? How big of an impact will this have?
Well, I think that the point that Ross brought up about this being, you know, just an extension of an established ad business is important, but it's, I think, equally important that you know, this is as lucrative as it's going to be, it's not really core to Amazon's business at all. They make so much money from so many different areas. And so in a way, they are introducing a unique kind of pressure to this market where, you know, ads aren't core to Netflix's current business, but they stand to be a big part of their future. Ads are definitely core to the business of a Hulu, for example, or a YouTube. And so having a competitor in the space who, you know, has no problem with underpricing competitors to get what it wants is pretty important and pretty worth watching. Flipping it around, though, I mean, I think that the thing that I think is so notable about this is that I think this is kind of like the final nail in the coffin of the era when, you know, streaming television was basically an ad-free proposition. You can pay more to get rid of the ads in Prime Video, but the reality yeah. Is that, you know, one of the largest, you know, sources of video content is now by default available with advertising. And I think that, you know, even though it's really just kind of a symbolic thing, I think to me, that's the most significant piece of this.
A lot of that happened with cable TV too. Like back in the 80s, a lot of those stations were ad-free and positioned as ad-free, and that cable was going to be pay television that was different than broadcast. And then 10 years later, they all had ads except HBO and Showtime and Cinemax, and cable looked a lot like broadcast.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how much longer the ad light, you know, promise that has defined a lot of ad-supported streaming. Just it'll be interesting to see how quickly that disintegrates, because, you know, as the linear audience continues to migrate out of linear television, the ad revenue is going to have to, for a lot of these companies, is going to have to come from somewhere. And a lot of that is going to be on the back of, you know, higher ad loads, unfortunately, for all of us.
Advertising services, that line item for Amazon, about 8% of the pie in Q3 of last year, waiting for the Q4 numbers to see how big that slice is now. But yeah, to Max's point, it's the second largest streaming player in the US by subscribers, by viewers as well, according to our forecast. So there's a significant player. And so as soon as they make a move, it will have some kind of an impact on the industry, a shift in the industry. And the fact that they are signing everyone up immediately, and that suggests that they could have estimates of about 70 to 100 million people, depending on who you ask, out the gate, which is a significant number of folks. The Adweek piece was noting that roughly 1 year into that ad tiers, Netflix had 15 million worldwide MAUs on its ads plans as of November 2023. I've seen some estimates, I think 23 million people on its ad plan for Netflix as well. So much lower numbers, unless, of course, those folks end up paying the $3 to avoid ads. Do we think that Prime subscribers will pay the extra $3 to avoid ads? Do you see that being a significant portion of the subscribers?
I'd be curious what Ross thinks about that. I am, you know, I'm going to pay the extra because I really, really don't like having ads break things up when I'm, you know, staring into my idiot box. I like to just kind of watch what I want to watch and get out. But I would imagine that a significant chunk of people are not going to pay the extra money.
Mm-hmm. I'd say under 30%. You know, yeah, they're going to have to be irritated by the ads to even know that the change has happened. So,
right.
You know, it's going to, because it's the default now, it's going to take a while to shift people over the other way.
There was some research that agrees with that point. Jeremy Goldman wrote a piece on this saying Amazon could struggle to attract Prime members to its ad-free option because there was a civic science study indicating less than 10% of people are considering the upgrade. Now, considering versus doing, two very different things. And to be honest, Amazon probably prefers it that way, because at least there's a way with Netflix, the consumer who is on their ad plan is typically a more high value consumer. So it's not like they need everyone to move over, because they're probably going to make more money per subscriber with someone who's watching the ads versus someone who isn't. Blake, what's your take here? So, I mean, you'd mentioned Amazon. I believe they're launching ads as part of a significant trend for 2024, correct?
It's not something necessarily that Amazon's doing for the first time, but introducing ads to their premium video platform. is definitely going to be a test as to whether if all this talk around shoppable media, particularly shoppable video advertising, is going to be able to resonate with consumers. I think right now Amazon is really pitching this sort of miracle ad product that you have premium video inventory with first party retail shopper data, and it's also in this, consumers are logged in, viewers are logged into the same account as their Amazon Prime shopping account. So just creating this trifecta of shopping, entertainment, and premier data that they are going to hope is really going to flatten that marketing funnel and get people to start buying products directly from their advertising content. So I think it's something that we've really been waiting to see for a while in terms of whether this sort of practice of shoppable media is going to take off beyond the confines of social commerce, where there has been some success in areas like TikTok Shop. But getting viewers to shop directly from the media that they're consuming on a television, let alone from an advertisement, it's a completely different scenario. However, there's a lot of money to be gained. And I think, you know, tying it back to this conversation about the lower CPMs for Amazon, they have a lot of small businesses that are selling on the Amazon marketplace. And traditionally, you know, premium video advertising was a big brand's game. I think what Amazon is trying to do now is open up that market of their smaller and mid-sized sellers into open up the video market to their, you know, smaller and mid-sized players, which is going to hopefully, for if you're Amazon, create a lot more incremental ad revenue rather than just trying to compete with the video platforms and the brands that are already advertising in these spaces.
Mm-hmm. Some great points. And final thing I'll say before we close out the story of the week, not all ad tiers created equal. When Netflix launched theirs, it did seem like a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to the share price not doing so well, and they needed to all of a sudden roll out ads to try to improve that. They rolled out with much higher prices, and it didn't really hit the same way that it seems like this could. This seems much more thought through for two reasons. One, targeting. The ad tier is going to offer standard demographic targeting and additional contextual and lifestyle parameters. Advertisers will eventually be able to find audiences using all of Amazon's data and engage through shoppable experiences, like what you were saying. And then secondly, comprehensive third-party measurement partnerships with Nielsen and others. So this seems much more ready out of the box versus other ad tiers that we've seen from video streaming platforms. That's all we have time for the story of the week. Let's move now to the debate of the week. Today's segment, Make the Case. For our panel, Max, Ross, and Blake present the for and against arguments for each of the following questions based on three news stories. Two contestants face off per question. The following takes don't necessarily reflect the analyst's personal views. Their job is just to present the best case regardless and offer objective analysis. Question one. Talking about honest advertising, Blake going up against Ross. There's a fine line between persuasive and deceptive advertising, writes our senior director of briefings, Jeremy Goldman. He notes tax software company TurboTax has come under scrutiny from the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, for deceptive ad practices related to its free, quote unquote, free tax products and services. The FTC says TurboTax must either A, make its so-called free products genuinely available to all folks, or B, provide disclosures about the percentage of customers who actually qualify for the free offerings. Jeremy says the FTC's firm stance against deceptive ad practices sends a clear message to companies about the importance of honesty and clarity in marketing. The question is, will we see a move to more honest advertising as a result of this or other cases? Blake, you're going to argue we will see a move to more honest and transparent advertising. Make the case. 1 minute on the clock.
Sure. I think that it's not necessarily honest advertising because of altruism from the advertisers. It's because of regulation, and the advertising industry has come a long way back from, you know, the Wild West when, you know, doctors were coming on TV on behalf of the cigarette companies to offer low tar alternatives, right? And you can't do that anymore because eventually, you know, it led to regulation that prohibited manipulation of the audience. And as the industry, you know, goes on, there's always going to be more regulation, which is going to further restrict what advertisers can and cannot do. So, you know, if honesty is the exact word, you know, if honesty rings, you know, it provides too positive of a connotation, then, you know, maybe that's a different story altogether. But in terms of, you know, regulation making, forcing advertisers to be more accurate in what they're selling, then sure.
Okay, Ross, we won't see a move towards more honest and transparent advertising. Make the case.
Like I said, we're in a different world than when doctors used to work with cigarette companies to market tobacco products. And I'd say, are we really? Because if we look at the Super Bowl from just a few years ago, we saw a ton of ads for fraudulent crypto companies, and they had a bunch of famous celebrity spokespeople. And this is the Super Bowl. This is supposed to be the most expensive advertising, the biggest branding, and even that is filled with BS. So the FTC enforces truth in advertising because it's assumed that otherwise advertisers will lie as much as they possibly can, and they have to have regulation against them to enforce them to be honest. So truth in advertising has become an oxymoron, and I don't see why that's going to change. Why is today any different than what we've experienced for the rest of our lives?
Some great arguments, gents. Max, any thoughts here? Where do you land?
I think that advertising inherently is going to is going to trend toward being dishonest, and there's only so much that can be done, practically speaking, to sort of legislate, you know, real truthness or directness about, you know, what's being sold. So, you know, I wouldn't hold out much hope for a new era dawning in terms of honesty in this space.
Positive. Okay, let's move to question two. We're talking.
Hey, at least they fund all that stuff that we like. You know, that all that media and entertainment wouldn't be possible if those advertisers weren't spending all the money on it.
Question two, Max versus Blake, for face computers. So the $3,500 mixed reality Apple Vision Pro is here. And as Brian X. Chen explains, he writes for the New York Times, this latest pair of extended reality ski goggles join a host of not terribly successful predecessors from Google, Meta, Snap, Samsung, and Sony, who are trying to create immersive experiences for getting things done by moving the body instead of typing on keyboards. The question is, are face computers inevitable? Max is going to argue that face computers are inevitable because he pulled the short straw, basically didn't get to the arguments in time to pick a different one. Max, 60 seconds on the clock. Good luck, my friend. Make the case.
What do you mean? This is always what I wanted to argue. No, you know what makes something real popular? Your boss telling you to do it. This is a technology that I cannot dispute that this is these kinds of wearable technologies have been a flop as consumer products. But I think that we are now nearly a decade into bosses really, really embracing the technology as a means of surveilling their employees, of enhancing their productivity through wearables. And, you know, you can either make people do it or you can ask them and rely on these social pressures that are inherent in workplaces to force your employees to put these things on their faces. I found this journal story from 2013 where there were, I think it was 80 or 90 different companies that were asked to participate in trials where people would put these pieces of wearable technology on while they worked to monitor their heart rate, where they went, what they did. And 90% of the employees that they asked to volunteer to do this said yes. So I think that these are inevitable, but they are inevitable as workplace technologies, not consumer technologies.
Blake, face computers aren't inevitable. Make the case.
Yeah, I don't know if I had a prepared statement against Max's highly dystopian proposition for, but I don't know. I mean, maybe for certain, you know, office jobs. But if the guy collecting my trash is wearing a headset to monitor his activity, I don't really know how productive that's going to be for anyone involved. And also, you know, these products are very expensive. So you're also going to have to get the company to, you know, make the investment in implementing something like this, which right now is, but particularly this new Apple product, mm-hmm. it's very expensive. And I think that's also what's going to deter consumers from trying it. These products, you know, the Apple product, it looks essentially the same. It feels essentially the same as some of these other flops. And even as they do get a little bit, you know, more slender, a little bit more integrated into, you know, the watch and the phone that everyone relies on, there's just, you know, flat out putting something over your face is way different than wearing a watch or putting a phone in your pocket. And there's really, you know, there's no other further explanation needed. They're just not inevitable. People aren't going to want this type of intrusive technology on their faces.
It's interesting, like that point you made about the investment, because they are expensive. This one's $3,500. Even if you're getting an Oculus, you know, they're not cheap. They're $400-$500, and times that by having many employees you have, and then hoping that technology doesn't go out of date in a year or less. I wonder if you're going to start to see some kind of like corporate rental agreements where, you know, Apple says, all right, we'll lease these to you. And if there's a new model, you'll get the new model and you'll get all the software updates and you hand them back in. We'll deal with all the repairs that you need to have or co-working spaces. Maybe WeWork has a bunch of these that you can use. So maybe that's a way of getting around this. They can get some money in from renting them without having to get people to fork out all this money. Obviously the $3,500 will come down, but it's too high right now.
Man, communal vision pros though. Ugh.
Yeah, you might have to.
I guess you could
own,
spray like, them down or
conjunctivitis,
something.
Conjunctivitis, like... pink eye.
Appealing.
Office pink eye.
Things are pretty bleak at the moment. If you look at sales of mixed reality and VR headsets, they fell 8% last year, according to research company IDC. So they're going in the wrong direction. And we have some numbers from our forecasting team on virtual reality headset users. We think about 37 million people in the US will use them this year. That's only about 11% of the country. And in 3 years' time, we think 12% of the country. Now, you could look at it as pre-pandemic, it was 6% of the country. So we're double where we were from there. But things have slowed down considerably, and it looks like they need a company or some kind of moment to give that a second wind. Let's move to our third question, gents. We've got Max going up against Ross. Talking about Netflix, saying that gaming is a long-term bet and that it's happy with its low-key start, writes Stefan Totillo of Axios, or Stephen Totillo of Axios. That might be how you pronounce it. He reminds us that Netflix just celebrated its second anniversary as a gaming provider, having released over 80 games, all free to subscribers and exclusive to mobile. The question is, will Netflix become a significant gaming hub? Max is going to argue that Netflix will become a significant gaming hub. Make the case.
So I think that I'm going to be a little bit lawyerly here and rely on, you know, being able to set the terms of what significant gaming hub means. I think that, you know, if this is something that turns into, let's say we fast forward 5 to 8 years and they've got 15 to 20 million people, which is, you know, a bit less than 10% of their subscribers playing games all the time. And maybe they've got, you know, more than half of those people are ad supported users. And so they're able to serve lots of gaming ads to those people. I think you could consider that a significant win. And that also feels extremely achievable. I think people think of gaming as being this thing that is done by, you know, hundreds and millions of people. And there are, if you look at the download numbers for things like Candy Crush or the number of people that just play random long tail mobile games, you get one picture. And then if you look at the people who are, you know, hardcore desktop gamers, you get a very different picture. So Netflix needs to decide which of those two poles it's going to be aiming toward and act accordingly. But I think aiming for casual folks is achievable, and they're well on their way.
Mm. Ross, Netflix won't become a significant gaming hub. Make the case.
So gaming isn't a revenue driver for Netflix. Netflix doesn't share any numbers on gaming usage because it has nothing material to share about it. It doesn't really market its games. Games are a way to retain customers, but they're not really a way for them to drive new ones. Gaming doesn't have a significant impact on Netflix's bottom line. It seems like it's unlikely to change that in the near term. And Google Stadia's failure showed that just because you have the resources and the technological capabilities doesn't mean that your company is going to succeed in gaming.
I would push back, though, on the idea that, I mean, I agree that currently it is not a customer acquisition tool, but I think it's not inconceivable to imagine that as they get better at this, that could start to happen. So if you look at the top most downloaded games of 2022, which was the most recent data I could find, they each cleared over 200 million downloads. And if you imagine a world where Netflix starts to get its kind of marketing pitch in order, they could maybe do something where there's some game that everyone is obsessed with. And maybe what they start offering is, you know, you can play this game for free for 30 days. And then after that, we're going to sign you up to our ad supported tier that includes everything else. And I'm sure for a not insignificant number of people every year, they'll think, well, I was kind of on the fence and I got rid of it, but I really do want to play this game and I get it for free. So let's just go ahead and do it. I could see that being a nice little at either retention or customer acquisition tool over the medium term.
Well, they probably need to change how their games are operated. Right now, they're only available on mobile.
Mm-hmm.
Most Netflix consumption happens on TV sets. There's no controller. Most Netflix users who already get the games for free aren't even playing them. So to go from that to like pulling in new people based on the strength of your games is a big jump, and they're gonna have to invest a ton for that to happen. I guess we'll see how committed they are. The GTA games was kind of a cool thing, but I don't know how many people want to play all the way through San Andreas on their phones.
For me, all the Netflix games are mobile, because I'll take the TV to the bedroom. I'll do it. I'll take it wherever I go, goddammit. I'll take it with me on the train. Glass half full. Netflix says engagement will, with its video game catalog, tripled throughout 2023. I don't know what engagement means, but that seems like a good number. And then glass mostly empty, according to Apptopia.
It's vague because it doesn't mean anything.
Thus far, could be possible. Thus far, only 1% of Netflix subscribers have played a video game on the platform, and that's have, not currently. But they seem pretty invested. We'll see if it works out for them. That's what we got time for the debate of the week. Very nice arguments, gents. We move now, of course, to our final segment of the show. It's Dinner Party Data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Let's kick things off with Ross.
So this data comes from Rover.com. It could be completely inaccurate because they didn't share much how they obtained this. But Rover is a dog walking service. And it's what are the most popular dog breeds in the United States? And the number one breed is kind of a cop-out.
Golden Retriever.
Well, Golden Retriever's up there. The number one is Mutt, which isn't even a breed.
What?
That's 60%. Of all dogs. And then you have Labrador Retriever, Golden Retriever, or Labrador Retriever, Golden Doodle, and Golden Retriever. So apparently Americans really like retrievers because all three of those dogs are types of retrievers.
Mm. How's Labradoodle doing?
Labradoodle was three. Or Labradoodle, you said, I got to look that up, because Golden Doodle was three. Labradoodle, and they only shared like the top 10. It's not the most exhaustive
list. Didn't make the top 10? What kind of list is this? Throw it out.
It's not. It's not in the top 10.
Did any of your dogs make the top 10, Ross?
No. Oh, well, actually, my dog Cooper did, because he's a mutt, so.
Cooper, well played. Of course he did.
Atta boy, Coop.
Strutting around the house, bragging now.
He's just sleeping right here.
Shout out to Coop, long-term listener. Because he has to. Ross is in the same room. Very nice, Ross. Let's move to Blake.
So this is some data that I was looking up, because I saw some people from the big CPG companies speaking at NRF, and one of them was the head of Mars Candy. So, and he was talking a lot about sort of trends in the candy market. So I wanted to look up the best selling candies in the US. So this data comes from March 2023, so it's pretty recent, and it's from So Sweet. And this is the best selling 10, the top 10 most sold American candies. Anyone want to take a stab at number one before I reveal the list?
Reese's something?
No, not Reese's.
I hope not.
Hershey's?
Nope.
Snickers.
Snickers. Oh, wow. Number one. Yeah.
Wow. Max. Kit Kat up there?
Kit Kat is definitely on there. Kit Kat's okay. Number five. I'll run through it real quick. Snickers, M&M's, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, ooh, Hershey's, Kit Kat, Twix, Skittles, Starburst, Sour Patch Kids, and number 10, kind of a sleeper, Jolly Ranchers.
Oh,
you don't
know.
People not talking about Jolly Ranchers.
Jolly Ranchers have expanded their product lines. They got like chewable things like Now and Laters. It's not just the hard candy.
Oh, Now and Laters.
You ever suck on a Jolly Rancher, like in between your top jaw and your bottom jaw, and then if you do it for too long, you can't open your mouth anymore?
Yeah, you need the hardcore dental floss.
Yeah.
Good times. Now and Laters, you can just use those for like tooth extraction.
Oh yeah,
those are kind of gross. I'm not a big Now and Later fan.
Yeah, go to the dentist, get your wisdom tooth out. Just chew on this, mate. Give it 5 seconds. Blake, you know that England does the best candy.
They do the best chocolate. Like Hershey chocolate's kind of it
terrible.
Yeah, I feel like you can put air quotes around the chocolate part of it for Hershey.
but the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, my friends.
Yeah.
Is an American delicacy.
Hershey's chocolate is as authentic as Kraft cheese.
Delicacy.
V, cut that out. Okay, Max, you're up, mate.
All right, so I am taking advantage of this being a video podcast. News to all of you that are listening to us on Spotify or Apple that this is a video. This episode is a video podcast.
Surprise. Go to YouTube/.
You should stay on audio.
Insider
you're
Intelligence
not missing
one. Okay. Thanks, Blake. We'll have you on the promo.
Yeah, let's get him mid thought in that, you know, movement of face that makes any of us look good.
Right.
Okay. No. But so anyway, I think V can put up on screen this thing that I found called the Mississippi Meander Map. So being a totally idiotic city mouse, I assumed that rivers, once they made their way, you know, from the top of whatever mountain they started at and made their way to whatever body of water they emptied out into, kept the same course, basically, that, you know, the Nile has gone in one direction for however many millions of years, the Amazon and so on and so forth. Turns out that is extremely wrong. I found this thing on the Public Domain Review, which is a map that someone named Harold Fisk made in the 1940s. He was a guy who worked for the Army Corps of Engineers, and he basically used both maps that had been made, you know, decades earlier, and then also aerial photography and looking at sort of changes in height of the basins to map out just how much the Mississippi River has changed where it goes over the last 100 years or so. And you can see from the pictures here that it is pretty stark. Some of it is because of human activity, people putting up dams, people cutting things, clearing away brush. But sometimes the river just, you know, changes its mind about where it wants to go. The article that accompanies this image has this really crazy example from I guess it was the 19th century. There was a town called Reverie, Tennessee, that had the Mississippi River flowing on one side of it. And in the course of one 24-hour period, because of weird weather, the river just moved to the other side of the town completely and walled it off. And all of a sudden, Reverie, Tennessee was in Arkansas instead of Tennessee. this just completely blew my mind, and I was so delighted to see it. And wow. I guess the 36 of you that tuned into the video episode will also see it and think it's super cool. But that's my 50. Dinner that's party data for the day.
So do you think there's people out there saying, back in my day, Manhattan used to be in New Jersey because the Hudson was over there?
Oh my God, absolutely.
The Hudson River app flows both ways. It always does. It does. And Max, is the city of Philadelphia not situated directly on a river?
It is between two rivers. Yeah, it's between the Schuylkill and the Delaware.
The Schuylkill?
So I think urbanites should have no excuse for not having a knowledge of rivers.
Listen, I was trying to just disguise the fact that I'm very stupid, okay? Like, that is the main takeaway that I've been trying to gloss up.
How did you come across this in the first? How does that happen?
So it's from the site, actually, Public Domain Review, which has a pretty incredible collection of images that are, you know, public domain. They have old medical textbooks. They have old pieces of art, strange tracts on stuff. They have an awesome gift shop. I think I was just trying to find something either for my house, or maybe it was like a gift giving season, and I was trying to find something, and I just came across this, and I was like, what am I looking at?
Next time I'm in Philadelphia, Max, I'm taking you out, my friend. We're going outside.
We go to the rivers?
Maybe not.
It's all right, gross over there.
I'm just kind of wondering.
Someone takes you to the river in Philadelphia, you better be pretty nervous.
Can you move the rivers for gerrymandering purposes?
Oh.
Someone listening to this has got to be thinking of an application for that.
Got to be thinking about it.
Where can we put this down to?
We just want these 30,000 people to be over here.
26 of dynamite later.
Very nice, gents. I've got one for you real quick. It's about retirement. You may remember, if you listened for more than 3 months, that I had some of these facts. I think it was an October episode, but I've got some new stuff for you. So, retirement facts. Who's retiring? The average age of retirement for Americans is 66. According to Gallup, up from 60 in the 1990s, Americans' life expectancy is 79. In 10 years, the number of Americans 65 plus will grow a staggering 40% from 56 million today to over 78 million people in 10 years' time who are going to be over the age of 65. How bleak are retirement savings accounts? Three facts for you, or stats. One, in 2022, almost half of American households had no savings in retirement accounts, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. A quarter of people had just $100,000 or more. One in 10 had over 500 grand. Sounds like a lot, but that's about 40K per year for each of the 12 years that people will live beyond retirement on average, so it's not a ton. Number two, according to PwC median retirement savings, total for 55 to 64-year-olds, it was about 120. That's what they have on average. The Government Accountability Office says, whilst that may sound like a lot, it translates into about $300 a week during retirement, well below unemployment insurance. Americans aged 35 to 44 have only 37 grand saved on average. And number three, part of the reason is because close to 44% of Americans 40 to 79 years old have taken money out of retirement savings, of their retirement savings plan, according to TD Ameritrade. So,
way to depress the hell out of all of us.
Welcome, folks. So here you go. Here's a little pick me up. It's not really. How much do you need to retire? That's what you're asking, according to Yahoo Finance, to keep living at or near your lifestyle while working. Experts suggest you only need between $500,000 to $1 million saved to finance your retirement years. So,
how do they know what my lifestyle is?
Oh, they know, Blake.
I don't think they do.
But what about my animals?
You're too bougie. Your animals?
My giraffes.
That's the problem. That's the very problem. According to wealth management company, actually, here's silver lining. According to wealth management company Natixis, the U.S. is the this isn't the great bit. The U.S. is the 20th best country to retire in. So instead of worrying about saving lots of money for retirement, new strategy, move to Norway, because they're number one. So I'll see you guys there. That's what we've got time for.
If you know someone who can get me in,
Into Norway?
You know my number.
I don't know. What do you, who do you think I hang out with, Blake? What kind of service am I moving in?
I would assume maybe I got an inn with Norwegians. It's very difficult to get into Norway.
It is? Would you say, like, from experience? Have you...
I've looked into it, yeah.
Okay, all right. We'll talk about that later. Sounds highly illegal. That's what we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Blake.
Always a pleasure.
Not for that last comment. Thank you to Ross.
Thanks, Marcus.
Thank you to Max.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
Thank you. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, Stuart, who runs the team, Sophie, who does our social media, and thanks to Lance, who runs our video podcast. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can find us on Instagram if you like. Insider Intelligence, one word for all the behind-the-scenes content you can possibly consume. We'll see you hopefully on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Stack Adapt. Happy weekends.